From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
What would Enda be talking about in New Zealand? I met a man with two kiwis in his hand.
I'm an archivist and it has taken me to interesting places. I started here in RTE in the television archives.
Did you? But you're okay now.
I'm okay. I used to...
These genes and molecules tell our thinking brains when we're hungry and not hungry, when we feel like going after food or not.
Coming up on this special Goddaughter's Birthday edition of Playback Daily. Goodbye, Leo. Hello, Simon. From archivist to author, Andrew Hughes on his new novel. And is middle age spread genetic? That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's just big-boned. Let's start with Oliver Callan having fun with the incoming Taoiseach, the Fine Gael Ardesh, and musing on what he reckons should be an entertaining week ahead in Irish politics.
Did you see Simon Harris the other night? It was the Ardesh. Now, Ardesh speeches, they tend to cripple the television ratings for the night on RTE over the years. But there may have been more interest in this one than usual for the novelty. And it was on early-ish in the Saturday evening as well. I like Simon Harris, I have to say. I think he's a brilliant performer. And he definitely has the common touch because there was a video out straight away of him glad handling and meeting people in Salt Hill. And we haven't seen that in a long time, have we? So he's clever. He's very, very clever. We know that. But he's very warm. And even when he's a little bit cringe, really, 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 he's kind of knowingly cringe. And I don't think there's ego there yet. Anyway, don't forget, men change when they become Taoiseach. And there have only been men in that office. All of them have. And if you're listening to Callan's Kicks, by the way, the comedy, it doesn't always say the nice things I'm saying about Simon Harris now. But that's because that show isn't an editorial, you see. So we're firm but fair. But I wish Simon Harris well, because that's simply wishing the whole country well, I suppose. And he and his family, they should really, really, really enjoy this week, particularly because after that, it's going to be rough, because it's rough in politics. And if you think he looks older than his years now, you ain't seen nothing yet, which is his catchphrase, isn't it? You ain't seen nothing yet because of this.
To anyone who thinks this party lacks energy, you ain't seen nothing yet.
It's following ever. At the Ardesh, Saturday night, Simon, he thumped the pulpit. He did the two hands, raised hands thing. Very hard to pull off two hands in the air and not look ridiculous. And he did all his promises. He did his pledges. He poked his head up and down. He's a bit of a noddy. And this, no joke, was his actual entrance music. That's right. The song is 50 years old, Backman Turner, but that was fine for the youngest ever Taoiseach. In fact, Miriam Lord has christened him the Yeti, youngest ever Taoiseach of Ireland. Yeti, that's a copyright. Miriam Lord, hope it's not stolen from you, Miriam, like the TikTok Taoiseach, which is now on The Guardian this morning. They've stolen that from Gallant's Kicks. I'm going to sue, I'm telling you here now. But that was his entrance music. He did a speech. The crowd kind of looked like the reluctant plus ones at a Jack Whitehall gig, if you know what I mean, you know. And some of his vows kind of sounded like criticism of his own party's time in office. You know, I don't know who's been in charge of housing and health, but the place is in bits. They made the heaps of it. Even the podium slogan, which is a new energy. Very good slogan, by the way. Sounded like a deep cut to sort of the old energy of Coveney and Fradger, who were out the door. And there were lots of people as well, because politics is rough and gossipy. People who wouldn't have dared to turn out at the Fine Gael event while Leo was the leader, they showed up, and another barb at him. Phil Hogan was there, Kate O'Connell. And Enda Kenny beamed in a video from New Zealand where he was doing a speech. I'm told about like something like 20, 25,000 euro was his fee, unconfirmed. So that's something for Leo to look forward to. What would Enda be talking about in New Zealand? I met a man with two kiwis in his hand. What would they get him to speak? His main legacy, we were told, when he left, remember, was his fantastic handling of Brexit in the first year after the vote. But that's the only thing they say that Leo got right. And then when Coveney faded into the hedges last week, like that Homer Simpson gif, they said, he was a great man because he sorted out Brexit for us. Who was it? Because Martin Fraser, who became our London ambassador, he got the credit for that as well. And Mairead McGuinness. Success has many, many mammies in politics. But now Simon Harris is going to, he's going to fix all the things that are broken in our country. I'm only joking. This week it is time to dole out the jobs for the knobs. So the reports, and they're all saying it in the papers today, Peter Burke is getting into cabinet. Why? Because when he's on radio shows, he sounds like he might be able to spell his own name. So that's kind of sufficient for entry to cabinet. The bar is low. The bar is low, you see. Helen McEntee. Now, Harris is very clever, you see. So she might be the only threat to his high chair. So he'll leave her in Justice, where she can flounder about for another year, which means promoting perhaps Jennifer Double Barrel TD, who in the most brazen move in the history of recent Irish politics has styled herself a future party leader out of nowhere. Even though she only she has her doll seat because Mary Mitchell O'Connor was shafted by her own crowd in the last elections. Politics. But he is more likely to promote Hildegard Nocton from the West, who hasn't been heard speaking out loud since she entered cabinet as chief whip. She'll be there a year and a half now. And Alan Dillon's been mentioned. He could get a junior ministry because he proved to be someone who could say words at Oireachtas committees over the last year. And he's from the West of Ireland, which does really well, of course, when it gets a minister, doesn't it? Murya, they're all saying over there. Anyway, the headline from the speech was the eye-catching promise of Simon Harris to build 250,000 houses over the next 5 years. Maybe he intends to do it by Minecraft or 3D printer or something. But the promise lasted less than 24 hours. So on Saturday he said, we will build 250,000 homes over the next 5 years. But on the Week in Politics, at lunchtime the next day, he says, I didn't make a promise of 50,000 homes a year. I made a promise that between 2025 and 2030, we'll deliver 250,000 homes. That doesn't mean a smooth delivery of 50, 50 and 50. You're supposed to wait until you're in office before fudging your promises. Do you not know? Do you not know how to do this? But anyway, if you think we haven't built enough houses.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
There you go.
And while running the rule over the new guy, Oliver couldn't help but spare a thought for the old guy.
By the way, today marks the final hours of lovely Leo's term in office. He will resign this evening at Áras an Uachtaráin, where President Higgins will try not to laugh out loud or look too happy. And then Leo will go off to live quietly from whence he came. Slytherin, I think. Back to Slytherin for Leo. Living out his days, plotting revenge on anyone who looked at him funny over the last few years, including the Scales. Never forget that Scales on Operation Transformation that said that Leo had the body of a 53-year-old. I will never forgive you. Hashtag ledgebag out. So enjoy it.
Yes, we'll always remember that Lionel Vardy guy. A quick pivot. Pivot! Now to sporting matters.
A number of surprises worth mentioning yesterday. Opening day, there were shocks. Wicklow caused one of the biggest upsets by beating Westmeath and handing Kildare extra incentive to avoid the Tailteann Cup. So Oisín McConville is over the Wicklow troops, and we'll come to more of Oisín McConville's family. He had a great day out yesterday as well. But there was also big surprises. Obviously, Cavan beating Monaghan was a bit of a surprise there, especially the 10 minutes of injury time. And Waterford stunned Tipperary in the Munster. And in the Examiner here, I'm looking this morning. This is fascinating. Waterford beating Tipperary in football in the Munster Championship. So they finished winless behind London at the foot of Division 4. They finished at the bottom of the bottom division, Waterford. But they are now, they just have to beat Clare to get into a Munster final where they'll be savaged by Kerry, but they'll at least be playing Sam Maguire football. It is absolutely brilliant, says Paul Shankey, because he says, there's no buzz that could replicate that. Two late goals from Tom O'Connell, two goals and 3 points he scored, sealing a change of fortunes that looked unthinkable after the break. So a big day out for them as well. And in ladies football, defending champions Kerry relinquished their National League title to Armagh, winning their first ever Division 1 title when they beat the Kingdom there. And one of the stars, standout star, centre halfback Lauren McConville from Armagh. So Armagh winning a famous win there. Lauren McConville's uncle is Oisín McConville of the great Armagh Cross Madeleine, the Cross dynasty. Up there, dynasty, her cousins actually would be the O'Neills, Rhian O'Neill in Armagh. It's all connected, you see, in the Ga-a-a. And the Liverpool fans in Ireland will be ruining the day because Man United once again failed, or sorry, Liverpool once again failed to beat Man United. So Jurgen Klopp will be, he says, they've only themselves to blame. They dropped more points in the Premier League title, failing to beat Man United again. They missed a record number of chances that United came from behind to lead before an 84th minute penalty from Mohamed Salah, rescued the point from Klopp's side in a chaotic 2-2, but brilliant draw. There was fabulous sport over the weekend. Arsenal are top of the Premier League table, and it is disappointing. It's not looking great now for Liverpool. I'm putting this in the sports section because the Wrestle fans will be delighted with it. WWE, it was WrestleMania. WrestleMania 40 now, believe it or not. It was played out at Philadelphia's Lincoln Financial Field over the weekend. And the big surprise of the event was Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Yes, that Dwayne The Rock, who obviously started his career And he was competing fully, fully competing in WWE for the first time in 11 years, teaming up with his cousin, we're using inverted commas, Roman Reigns, to beat Cody Rhodes and Seth Collins. Here's The Rock talking about his going back into the ring for WrestleMania 40.
The fans get an opportunity to enjoy 2 days of the Super Bowl, if you will, and enjoy great matches, great entertainment, and also, in addition to that, we get to create more opportunities for the wrestlers and for the performers. And I grew up in the world of wrestling. For those of you who don't know, I was born into it. My grandfather wrestled, my dad, my cousins. My grandmother was the first promoter in Hawaii. So I come from a long lineage. So creating opportunity for wrestlers and performers is something that is very important to me and important to us as a company. So I can't wait. In this WrestleMania, WrestleMania 40, we look to put on, hopefully, the biggest WrestleMania of all time. I am returning into the ring, so I'm going to put the spandex on. And I got to start my diet. And I can't wait. I think we are creating something that should be, I think, pretty cool for the fans and pretty entertaining.
And it was pretty cool for the fans. Pretty cool for the fans and very entertaining.
A decidedly dubious ending to Oliver's review of the sporting weekend, in the sense that WWE WrestleMania has about as much sport in it as San Diego Comic-Con. But I'm afraid that's where the Oliver Callan musings have to stop for today. A young girl was rescued from the sea in Dunleary, County Dublin, on Saturday at the height of the Storm Kathleen winds. The girl's puffer jacket, her ability to remain calm, and the fact that she floated on her back with her arms outstretched are the factors credited with helping to make the incident a good news story rather than a bad one. And this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, Rosie O'Regan, Education Officer with Water Safety Ireland, and John Doyle, Head Coach and founder of Poseidon Lifesaving Club, spoke about talking to our children about staying safe in the water. Rosie teaches water safety to primary school children.
Of course, at first I teach the PAWS programme, so that's our primary aquatic water safety in schools. And one of our key messages when we're teaching that programme in schools is to teach them to float like a star. So that's exactly like what you said. We teach the kids that if they're in a situation where they fall into the water or they get into trouble when they're in the water, that they can turn onto their back so that they are looking up to the sky, their head comes back and their arms and their legs come out nice and wide, and they in turn float like a star. So they're in their most buoyant position like that.
Mm-hmm. And what do you tell them about their ears? Because many people will know that young children get a bit freaked out when the ears go in. Should they worry about that?
We tend not to worry about that. I think what's important when you're talking to the small kids is that we keep the information or our key messages nice and short. So if they can remember, if they're in a situation like that, just all they have to do is float onto their back and put their hands out nice and wide and their legs out nice and wide. Kind of naturally in that position, you'll be nice and buoyant. So hopefully you'll be a little bit higher out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
So we wouldn't really focus on too much more than that key message.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's the shock as well. If you're falling into, particularly into cold water, you know, how is your body going to react to that? And will you be able to calm yourself enough to get into that star position?
Well, that's it, of course. I mean, a lot of people don't realise we're now in some of our coldest seawater temperatures of the year. We're kind of 10 degrees at the moment, and it only really rises in Ireland up to 17 degrees. So of course, naturally, when you get in, you're going to have rapid breathing, anything like that. So, you know, by getting onto your back and floating like that, you really give yourself and kids have the opportunity to slow down the breathing and take control of the situation themselves.
Mm-hmm. John, I know you deal a lot with this in the work that you do in the life-saving course. Tell us more about cold water shock.
So cold water shock is what happens when the body is immersed in water. So a fellow called Mike Tipton, in conjunction with the RNLI in Portsmouth University, they were using research to try and find out why people drown. And what Mike did, he put very fit young people into cold water, pretty much around 10 degrees. These people knew they were getting into water. They were monitored. And what he saw was that their heart rate was spiking hugely. Blood pressure was going up. But actually, oxygen levels were falling because they were hyperventilating. And so what they came up with the idea is, how can we give them time? Because after about a minute, it goes right back down. Not quite normal, but it's much more manageable. So how can we give people time to get themselves, to get their heart rate down, to get their oxygen level back up? And it was the float to live, what they came up with. So what happens is, you, as Rosie was saying there, you lie on your back, you look at the roof, look at the sky, and you stay calm, and you're giving yourself that 1 minute. So after that, then you can nearly get yourself out of difficulty if you're not too far from shore, or you can call for help. And what happens normally is, when people do fall into water, they're not expecting it. So after bodyboarding and swimming, the next reason why people get into difficulty is actually walking. So they're not actually expecting to be in the water at all. So they get that gasping response and they fall in. They try to climb on the water, which, it's Newton's third law. For every action, there's an equal opposite reaction. So if you climb up in the liquid, you will bob back down. And each time they bob, they're inhaling water. So after a certain amount of time, they'll inhale too much water, and 1.5 litres of seawater inhaled is actually fatal. So it is really important that they stay calm, as Rosie said, lie on their back and float to live.
Yeah, I mean, but it's that staying calm bit, that's the hard bit, right?
Yeah, it's one thing knowing this. It's another thing practicing it. And so what we do with the kids is we do a lot of watermanship. So we put them in. So you can actually bob in the water with your face pointed at the roof and be your legs vertical in the water. And your body will want to float as long as you keep a little bit of oxygen in your lungs. It's like buoyancy. Mm-hmm. So and trying to encourage people that. So even parents, when they're getting into the pool and they're playing with their kids, then go for them, have a go at floating in a swimming pool. So if you can float a little bit in a swimming pool, you can float a lot in the sea, because the salt water will keep you a lot more buoyant. So it's really important. So it's one thing we say, the message is, okay, float to live. But a lot of parents bring their kids swimming. So have a bit of fun with them. Used to lie on your back together and have a competition who can stay floating the longest. So they themselves will get that feeling as parents if something ever happens to them, if they fall in.
Yeah, and Rosie, just coming back to, when an emergency happens, you know, we often see people who will try to help somebody who has fallen into the water, and those people can get into difficulties themselves. I know that was an element of what we saw at the weekend. What does Water Safety Ireland advise for anyone who might witness an incident happening?
Yeah, so again, you know, when I'm going into the schools, definitely a key message for us is that you never get into the water yourself. You know, that's likely to end up, like you said, two people in the water and the situation is worse. So we always firmly teach the kids, you know, for non-contact rescues. And it's something that when I go into the schools and I run programs, you know, we might have a bit of theory, and then we definitely go out and we practice these non-contact rescues using, you know, our public rescue equipment. So that's the ring buoys. And we would practice that with the kids.
But the advice is, do not go into the water. You try and reach in rather than getting in yourself.
Yes, don't get in. And then with our younger kids, so we would teach to stay safe. So staying safe spells out stay away from edges. So with our very small kids, they learn that acronym there. But yes, definitely not to get in yourself.
And John, we heard as well, as I mentioned at the beginning, about the puffer jacket and the role that played in the incident at the weekend. And I think probably like a lot of parents, I was mentally going through, you know, what coats do my children have? Should they have one of these coats? But really, we shouldn't be considering that as part of our water safety advice, should we? I mean, it was a fortunate coincidence.
No. Yeah, no. So with the research that they showed in Portsmouth, they show that the clothing that people have on will create a certain amount that will trap a bit of air as well.
John Doyle, head coach and founder of Poseidon Lifesaving Club, and Rosie O'Regan, education officer with Water Safety Ireland, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about safety in and around the water. Railthorn spoke to Jo Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line about what happened to her recently going through security at Dublin Airport.
I was flying to Donegal, from Dublin to Donegal.
Yeah, okay.
So I was going through security, and they have those new body scanner things stand in front of.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I've been through them in a few other places. I've been to Glasgow, not a bother. And I wear a breast prosthetic where I had a mastectomy 15 years ago.
Okay.
And before this, they weren't even an option. I might get a pat down now and again at any given airport, but no bother. So automatically, these new scanners, they show up a little triangle and a warning light, like the robot in Danger, Danger.
Okay.
And in other places, I've just got a pat down or a, oh, yeah, yeah, that's me, breast prosthesis. Oh, right, no bother. But this time, the security officer stood in front of me. It was a female.
Okay.
And she said, what's this? Well, that's my bean bag, as I call it, because it is literally a bean bag, the one that I use. It's my breast prosthesis. And she went, I have to see it. And I looked at her because we're in the middle of the security hall.
Yeah, of course.
Loads of people running around, and I'd never come across this before. And actually sitting here talking to you, I can feel myself actually trembling now.
Mm.
So I just went, it's a breast prosthesis, because I thought maybe she hadn't heard me right.
Okay.
She just went, I have to see it. And she stood there, and it was like a rabbit in the headlights. And I just put my hand down my top, down underneath, into my bra. Now, there's special bra pockets, and you have to manipulate the thing in and out. It just doesn't slip in and out.
Of course.
So I'm starting hoking around and poking and trying to get it out. And she went, okay, that's grand. And away you go. So I went off to collect my rucksack. And do you know what? I think it was about half an hour later that it actually occurred to me, what the hell just happened? Because this was in the middle of everywhere. And there's me with my top halfway down to my bra trying to get a hold of this. Because if I'd pulled it out, to be honest, I don't know, I wouldn't have got it back in without having to go into the toilet and get totally undressed. You know?
Yeah.
That only occurred to me afterwards. So, yeah. So I wrote into them. And
at any stage, did they offer you any alternative? They say, would you like to come into a room? Or
no. No. And it never occurred to me because she was standing there in front of me waiting.
And you are clear, but just for our listeners, because I want to embed it. You're clear that you used the word breast for a start. This is to do with my breast prosthesis.
Yes.
Yes. And you heard the word breast.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I assume that she heard the word breast, that she heard the word prosthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she didn't understand it. I don't know, because I know that before I had a mastectomy, I probably might not have known exactly what that involved. But yeah. I'm not a security officer in the airport. And as I say, I've been in other places. I've been in Glasgow. I've been in Amsterdam. There's been a quick pat down. Coming back home from Donegal, from Carrickfinn Airport, there was a, right, gotcha. You know? So not a bother.
And I presume people, other passengers, given that it's always busy.
The whole world. The whole world was passing through Dublin Airport.
Okay.
This was the weekend before St. Patrick's Day. So, yes, it was quite crowded. A lot of people were flying out.
Okay. Now, you did get on to DAA.
I did. Yeah, I did. I emailed them, yes. I sat I actually sat and cried on the airplane. The irony is, the airplane from Dublin Airport to Donegal, you're only about 20 minutes in the air. But anyway, so I was waiting for a lift on the other side, and I opened up the laptop and I just wrote back to them and I said, look, you know, here, this is what happened. My last sentence to them was, what happens next time I go through? And that is what I'm really interested in for myself and for all the women who wear a prosthesis. I was looking it up on Google there. Now, in 2021, there were 1,615 mastectomies. That's only 1 year.
Yeah.
Now, how many of us, you know, are going to be passing through Dublin Airport? And what happens next time? So I'm still waiting for them to give me a detailed, this is the protocol. And I'd also like to see, and I'd like to make this point, that they need to put it up somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Online, that this is what happens, because with these new scanners, this didn't happen before.
Ah,
you know, before they were installed. So this is relatively new, but it has to be dealt with in a dignified way.
And just on your point about the number of women that have had mastectomies. And like, we discovered it, it's 8 weeks ago now, when the government announced, not a plan, but the government made a decision to cut back on the small subsidy, a small subsidy that they gave to women post-mastectomy for clothing, like you've just referred to.
Yeah.
Railton. And the government abandoned it now. They reinstated it within 48 hours. But the number of women who were affected by it from all over the country was astonishing, I'd say. So you're right, there's a lot more women in that situation than... Now, have they given you the protocol, no?
They've said, let me see now. I'll go back up to the second email. A search must be undertaken. A hand search must be conducted.
If the machine goes off, yeah.
Now, they do said, and this is what really annoyed me, was, however, it should be noted that any customer who is required to undergo a hand search can request a private search. It shouldn't be a matter of requesting.
Mm-hmm.
Me requesting, they should actually be requesting. Okay,
they should be saying to you,
because they mention to protect their privacy and dignity. Well, to be honest, my privacy and dignity was not protected that day. It's not up to me, because it's not up to me to this is my point, to ask for it. It should be offered full stop. It is a breast prosthesis.
Yeah.
It's not a plaster on a finger.
That's Railthorne talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about her treatment by security personnel at Dublin Airport recently. Author Andrew Hughes' new book, Emma Disappeared, has been described as normal people, but with murder. His last book, The Coroner's Daughter, was named as the One Dublin One Book title for 2023. And Andrew joined Oliver Callan in studio this morning.
Let's get into it. What is the background? Because it's unusually, it's set in 2018, isn't it?
It's 2018, 2019. That was one of the kind of, you know, COVID hit, in its case of, do I deal with COVID or either set it before or just after it? So
good decision.
It's a very much contemporary, but kind of ambiguous about what exact year it was. But yes, Emma Hart is a young graduate. She's a young entrepreneur. She has gone missing. All of Dublin is talking about it. The protagonist of the book is a man called James Lister. He's an archivist in the National Library. He likes to present himself, especially online, as very much a progressive, you know, ally of the oppressed and women in particular. But he has been showing very much undue interest in this particular case of Emma Hart.
Yes.
And perhaps as the story goes on, we shall find out that he knows more, perhaps, than he should.
What does he know? And he seems like a sort of a normal enough guy, doesn't he? Where did he come up with this? He's an archivist, so is that your background?
He's an archivist. Yeah, I happen to be an archivist as well. James Lister lives in Botanic Avenue, which is where I used to live. His local is Fagan's in Drumcondra. His favourite drink is Hophouse, just like me. But there the similarities end.
Okay.
Once you get into the darker recesses of the mind, it's all made up. Yeah, I suppose it's a bit of write about what you know. So that the character kind of popped into my head fully formed. Also, like, archives, I'm an archivist and it has taken me to interesting places. I started here in RTE in the television archives.
Did you?
But you're okay now. I'm okay. I used to watch The Late Late Show on prime time as a job. It would be my job to catalogue them. So
right.
Very, you know,
wow.
An enjoyable job. It has taken me to interesting places like Tully Nally Castle and Killigar House. And so it just struck me that archives, as an archivist, could be an interesting background for the character. Then have him working in the National Library in Dublin, just so we can soak up that Dublin atmosphere. It's close to Trinity College. He strikes up a relationship with another Trinity College graduate. So we kind of bring in the idealistic world of Trinity students and their particular interest in this missing person's case. Mm-hmm. It was a case of writing about what you know. And it was nice just to set it in the Dublin that I know.
It is, and thank God you didn't give it all fake names and pretend it's a kind of a phony Irish city, because it drives me mad.
Yeah, and I tried to do that as much as possible. Like, Fagans and is real. He has his first date in Neary's, just off Grafton Street. Obviously, Trinity and the National Library are real. The Botanic Gardens plays a big role. He lives in Drumcondra. So, and it was nice to kind of set stuff around that north side location as well.
It's lovely, yeah. Drumcondra, obviously very special to you.
Yeah, my mam grew up there, just around the corner from the Cat and Cage. And so ever since all of us have come to Dublin for college or whatever it is, we've always kind of been very much Drumcondra focused.
Yeah.
So it was nice to kind of set the book there. And the Botanics was a great location. I lived just beside it, and which was fantastic during lockdown to have the Botanics just a kilometre away once it opened up again. And I remember saying, why not have this as a possible setting for... I won't say what might happen, but it's a possible setting for
things
for the
happen,
shenanigans.
It's a very important location.
The shenanigans that happen, yeah.
Yes, Mark, because my kind of, you're from Wexford, is that right?
That's right, Enniscorthy.
And I'm from Monaghan. Drumcondra is kind of my hinterland for a long time as well in Dublin, right, yeah. Where the Culchies, it's sort of like safe territory, isn't it?
It is.
Entry it's point
kind of,
to Dublin.
There's St. Pat's there where the, you know, a lot of teachers come up, and that might be part of it. And
feels like a kind of a Culchie town.
Yeah.
Drumcondra.
It's very, very well.
In fact, you probably had the same experience to me. We go into Fagans, which is a beautiful pub, and hoping that Bertie wasn't there. Because people used to be always going, oh yeah, I can't believe the Prime Minister is really here.
Yeah, it kind of added a bit of excitement. I remember then myself and my dad went for a pint in the Goose, which is not too far away. And
yeah, he was there as well.
Bertie came in as well.
You couldn't get away. I'm not saying it was bad. It was just that you always had to kind of speak to him, and he'd speak to you about football.
And if there were kind of tourists there, you would kind of feel you have to kind of nudge them there. There's our Prime Minister. He just happened to come in.
So it's such a good idea to have this whole Drumcondra lifestyle in through this novel, and this is where James Lister is hanging out.
Yeah.
But the real crack are the students who, and you're kind of having fun with that whole podcast online, online sleuths basically, who think they know more than the Gardaí.
Absolutely. It's part of this this persona that Lister presents to himself. He very much, it's kind of what he does in general. He always calibrates what to say and how to think. Mm. So he has this internal inner monologue that we get to see throughout the book, which might be very different from how he presents himself to the world. And like online, he has the perfect opportunity to always say the right things, always to support the right causes. And because of that, he gets drawn into this group of very much idealistic and kind of activist students. And so Lister kind of looks at them with a bit of a jaundiced eye. But he's also interested in a relationship with one of them, Libby Miller. And so we, as the book goes on, we might fear for Libby Miller and what Lister's intentions towards her are. There's already a missing person going on. Could Libby?
That's probably the normal people bit that they're talking about, that relationship, because it's
absolutely
slightly tortured, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that's it. It's as if what if in normal people one of the group happened to be perhaps a psychotic in some fashion, up to no good, perhaps involved in a murder to some degree. How would that dynamic play out?
There's less communism than the Sally Rooney stuff. To be fair,
it's a bit more surface level. That's the type. I mean, Libby and her friend Miranda are very much down to earth and pure in their intentions. Pascal, their friend Pascal, is slightly not quite as sincere. He is, again, he's a bit like Lister in that you feel that he's. This progressivism of his is a front. Lister kind of sees through that. Pascal is the type of guy who says, what feminism needs is my guiding and steady hand. Where Lister sees through that.
And he likes breaking privacy for online purposes as well, doesn't he, for his campaign? Yeah, this Pascal character, yeah.
Yes, he has no problem in tweeting whatever he knows about just for online clout.
So what is your novel saying to us about social media?
Well, I think, ultimately it is to be conscious of the dangers of what we reveal about ourselves. So much is available online and we put out so much, and perhaps we aren't aware or fail to be conscious sometimes of what people can find out about us. Mm. And for somebody like Lister, who, I mean, the very first scene, he sits down beside Libby on the bus. It's just a chance. He's going into work. Libby Miller happens to sit beside him. She opens up her laptop and her name is displayed on the login screen.
Yeah.
And Lister's the type who would just, he dips his hand into his pocket and pulls out his phone and Googles her name and sees what comes up.
A height of creepiness.
It is. And so he is interacting with this stranger who sits beside him, liking her tweets and so on. And she's kind of confused about who this man is who's liking her tweets. She's never come across him before. Little does she know that he's actually sitting beside her.
That is pretty creepy, in fairness, but very believable in our benighted era of social media. Author Andrew Hughes there talking to Oliver Callan about his new book, Emma Disappeared, which is published by Hachette Books Ireland. The ongoing struggle of parents of children with scoliosis to secure surgery for their suffering children was again highlighted on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. And once again, it was reporter Brian O'Connell doing the highlighting. Brian spoke to one family who are experiencing delays in surgery for their son, Noah.
Noah is seven. He's from Limerick. He's one of 270 children waiting on vital spinal surgery. And like many, unfortunately, he's been on a waiting list for far longer than he should have been. The curve in Noah's spine, first diagnosed 5 years ago, it's impacting some of his vital organs. He has complex health issues as well. So already in recent months, he has had several surgeries cancelled. And the effect on this, as you can imagine, is each time his family get their hopes up, they talk to him about having his surgery, and then their hopes are dashed at short notice. Now, Noah's mum, Una, began telling me after several cancelled surgeries, they've now been given a separate date for Noah's surgery.
So at the moment, he's waiting on spinal surgery, which we do have a date for, provisional date for the 15th of April. So he would have been cancelled a few times over the last few months. Back in December, it was due to Noah himself, he had complications due to brain surgery, so he wasn't fit for surgery. Then there was a few dates recently where it was cancelled. Just maybe 2 weeks ago, another date was cancelled because I questioned if there'd be a neurosurgeon in the theatre when he was having his surgery done.
Just to go back a little bit, how long is Noah waiting for surgery, and what is the kind of surgery he's waiting for, and why does he need it?
Well, I suppose it is going back a few years that he's needed spinal surgery, but Noah also has a Chiari malformation, which is kind of like a bone at the back of his head going down into his spinal cord area. So they could never do the spinal surgery until his brain surgery was done first. So once that went ahead, then we were starting to get dates for his spinal surgery. He's waiting to have rods put into his spine because he has severe scoliosis with like severe rotation as well.
Because the scoliosis, as we know, can impact significantly on vital organs if it isn't arrested.
He vomits a lot and we don't know if it's because it's pressing on his stomach. Mm-hmm. There's so much going on at the moment. He actually has swollen knees. That's from the scoliosis. It's like bursitis of the knees. Mm-hmm. One leg shorter than the other. And he has hip dysplasia as well. So all that is coming from the spine and the rotation of it.
I mean, there's been a lot of focus on this issue for a number of years, and obviously in the past year and a half, particular focus. What's been your experience in the past, say, year?
Just all the cancellations, I think, is very unfair because you get so prepped and there's so much to organise, like with surgery, and sure, then you've spoke to Noah as well to kind of prep him for it as well.
Are parents being listened to now?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think every time, I would have never had a voice until I went public, and I just think going public is the only way, and it's awful really because you feel really bad because you're not slating the doctors and the surgeons like they're all brilliant. It's more like the government and the fact that they hate the waiting lists, and then the fact that if kids are left waiting and then you have a backlog, it's not good enough really.
Brian, there was talk at one stage of families being able to access treatment abroad or even to get a second opinion from medics outside of Ireland. Was that an option for Noah?
Well, this is something that has been put forward. It's often signalled by government as one solution, possibly for some families. Several years ago, when this issue came up, there was a plan to try and access treatments in Germany, for example. There was quite low take up of this, and there have been commitments again since last year, which I'll come back to. I did ask Una about whether seeking treatment abroad was an option for their family.
It's not as easy as it sounds. And I know everyone was like, oh, go abroad, and it wasn't about the money. Like, I know it's going to cost money as well, but it wasn't even about that. It's just the fact that if I went abroad with Noah, they're focusing on his spine when he has a whole load of problems. He's very complex. It was just the fact that you could be stranded over there. I was warned that that could happen.
How's Noah doing?
He's doing good considering, yeah, he's suffering since Christmas, I suppose. It's the first time he's ever really complained of pain. But when we had a meeting last week, they did say that he was gone stiff. And they've never said that before. They said at Christmas, actually, that he was fine and flexible. It has got to him now, all right. There's days where he can't bend down to pick things up off the floor. A lot of the time he's saying he's sore, that his back is sore. He can't walk too far. He needs to be lifted, or he'll start, and he vomits a lot if he gets excited or on exertion and stuff. So, but other than that, like, he is a bubbly little boy.
We know we've been building, and we're soon to be completed, the most expensive children's hospital in the world. Do you think that will make a difference?
Are they going to start hiring more surgeons? And I do think they definitely need more resources and staff, because it's never going to work if there isn't a range of surgeons available for when somebody is out, that there is someone else to take over.
I would imagine for you, you want to get to a point where you're not having to go public in order to get essential healthcare for your son.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it would be great if it's just plain sailing, and like, we all understand that if there's emergency, then there's cancellations, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But cancelling all the time is very frustrating, and especially when you're looking at your child and they're not the same, because they're suffering and it's affecting their daily routine and things like that. So, like, it's very unfair on the family and the little fella that's suffering as well. Mm-hmm.
So we wish Noah well on the 15th of April, Claire, when hopefully he'll have his spinal surgery. But as you heard, accessing treatment abroad, it's not something Noah's family think would work for him. He has a multitude of health complications. It has been put forward, as I said, as a solution for some families. But at the very least, some now want clinicians from outside of Ireland to review their patient files. In a reply to me last October, the Department of Health told me the minister supported the request for a second medical opinion, and I was told back then he had asked the HSE to facilitate this. Now advocacy groups say external second opinions are not being offered or funded as a general practice, and this is something that they want.
Now, you asked the department about this, Brian.
Well, they told me requests for second opinions have been facilitated for all children in the original group of patients who are in this external review that's taken place. That would include two families that requested a referral as well, and it necessitates referrals outside of the country being facilitated. Any other patients and families who wouldn't be in that group that are being looked at by this external review, they will be facilitated within the public system for a second opinion. The decision then to seek an additional opinion for any patients, it's clinically informed, it will be facilitated, they say, on a case-by-case basis.
Today with Clare Byrne reporter Brian O'Connell talking about children waiting for scoliosis surgery this morning. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, our intrepid host spoke to Billy O'Toole and Nicky O'Toole while balancing their child Nisha on his knee. Billy told Ray about finding out he had cystic fibrosis and how he dealt with it as a teen and a younger man.
So Nisha's on my knee now. That's for the moment anyway. We'll see how it goes. So you're 37,
Billy. 37, 38 next month.
Right, okay. One so I suppose let's start at the beginning. You're the youngest of six.
Yes, I'm the youngest of six. Six O'Tools, should I say.
Right.
And they were O'Tools. Unfortunately, we lost one brother back in 1966 to cystic fibrosis.
Before you were born.
Before I was born. But the other five are alive and healthy.
Right. So I suppose as a result of losing that brother, your parents knew that they, you know, it was in the genes.
Yes. So cystic fibrosis, you have to have the genetic, basically, you have to have the CF gene to have a child with CF.
Right.
A 1 in 4 chance.
Aha. So was he the firstborn?
He was the firstborn. He was born in 1966.
Right.
So the year that England won the World Cup.
And what age was he then when he died?
He was only a few. He was about 12 months.
Right.
12 months. He wasn't. Okay. Didn't make it out of the hospital, unfortunately.
And did you chat to your parents then about knowing that there was a 1 in 4 chance going ahead? No, not really.
It was kind of CF in our family was a bit. We didn't talk about it. We treated everybody the same.
Yeah.
Nobody was sick per se, you know. And I suppose nobody ever thought of CF as that chronic illness that it's known as.
Yeah, I suppose that was great for you as a child, because it's not, you were sort of in denial a bit. You did everything that all your mates did.
100%. Yeah, and then I suppose as time went on, I kind of seen myself and I was lagging behind my friends. As my friends were growing older, they were getting bigger, they were getting stronger. I was running around the field and I could feel myself falling back a bit more. So then I kind of knew things were a little different from everybody else.
But I suppose up until 12, 13, you were able to match your friends?
100%, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They'd say different, but yeah. I definitely was, yeah.
Yeah. So then teenage years, and this is, it happens with a lot of people who have an illness, that they've been accepted and they've managed up until then. And then I suppose the gap opens up.
Yeah.
And you can't do all the things that your mates can do.
Yeah, it was a funny one because I suppose anybody would ask me about CF. Now we're talking about 25, 26 years ago.
Yeah.
CF wasn't what it's known for now. You know, everybody knows about CF now. Well, I'd hope with all the campaigning that we've done.
Yeah.
It was kind of, what's wrong? You know, even in school one day, somebody said to me, I heard you're anorexic, you're in hospital. And you're kind of like, how do you explain that it's cystic fibrosis? Yeah.
And you didn't want to be known as the sick child either? The sick,
No, I was too brave and too...
No, you go to your mum. There you go.
I was too, I suppose, not concerned is the wrong word. I was too, I want to be a lad. I want to be one of the lads. Yes. I don't want to be known as the person that was going to be sick the rest of their lives.
And to use that word again, so defiantly then, your late teens, you were doing what lads do in their late teens.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was maybe my downturn, but I wouldn't change it for the world.
But I suppose it brought you to a point where you had to have a reality check.
Yeah, I've had a few since.
but your consultant in Bowman sat you down.
Yeah, when I was 18, I suppose I was in and out of hospital a lot more, and I was in Castlebar General. Dr. O'Neill, who does phenomenal work down there, said, I can look after you to a certain point, but now you've kind of got to the adult side of CF. So I went to see Professor McIlvany, and basically he did a full NCT on my lungs, liver, kidneys, pancreas, everything that affects cystic fibrosis. He did, and he came back with the results, and I had osteoporosis, I had liver disease, I had, my lungs were failing.
Right.
And he basically said, you know, you've got a few years left. And it was like this sitting across the table.
A few years left and you were 18?
Yeah, yeah. He says, it was like this sitting across the table from him. And he was kind of breaking this news. And I was like, okay, I got serious issues here. And that was kind of the reality check. Well, CF has now taken over my life. Mm. Before that, I was like, you know, that'll be grand. Same as Irish. Everybody Irish would say, that's grand. Not going to worry about it.
But although you were getting more sick, you were still functioning.
Oh, 100% functioning at that time, yeah. I was still going to discos, parties, staying out till 3 or 4 in the morning, doing what every other 18, 19-year-old would be doing, but at a different level, you know. I knew I was sick, didn't worry about it, but knew in the back of my head that, God, I've only 3 or 4 years left.
Right.
So it was kind of party mode, but I'm going to die.
So eventually you had to have a double lung transplant.
Yeah.
That's major, major, isn't it?
You see, Ray, you'd say it's major. Everybody else would say it's major. But when you get to a stage and you're 3 weeks in and out of hospital, so 3 weeks in, 2 weeks out, weeks in, 2 weeks out, you get to that mindset where you're like, I've no choice. You know, it's either live or die. So I went to Ken Egan, who's basically one of the biggest doctors in Ireland for transplants. And his brother, Jim Egan, his brother Ken, was my local GP. So he said no the first time. He said, no, you're too well. We don't, because it's a double-edged sword. Transplant is a double-edged sword, like most people know. You're not sick enough to get the transplant. In my head, I was like, this is crap. I am sick. You know, I'm dying.
And then you can be too sick to get the transplant because it's major surgery.
Double-edged sword, yeah. So you have to be at the right level.
Yeah.
Said no the first time, said no the second time. And then in June 2010, I was on the list and I was sent to Newcastle at the time. And I did a week of basically every test that can be possible. You need to be sick enough, you need to be physically well to take the transplant, and you need to be mentally well to cope with the afters of the transplant.
And then do you sit and wait? Where did they get the lungs from?
At that time, now it's changed now, the Mater look after everybody in Ireland, lungs, kidneys, liver, whatever you need. But at that time, the Mater and the Freeman Hospital in Newcastle had an agreement, whereas you can wait in either, and basically the Freeman had more, back in 2010,
of course,
they had more
bigger
experience.
Population, but they have a bigger population to draw from
as
well. Yes,
so I got the transplant from Newcastle.
Okay.
Unfortunately, somebody had to die
for
that. And the night I got the phone call, I was due to go into the hospital on the Friday. I went in, that Friday evening, I got a phone call from Castlebar General, who basically said to me, the consultant wants you back in straight away. And now I'd planned to go out that weekend. I was like, no, I'm not going in. I'm going out. Very stubborn in my head. On the Saturday night, I got a phone call to say that there's a pair of lungs in Newcastle. The poor guy that died had a brain tumour.
Right.
Went on the operating table for a normal routine operation and sadly passed away.
Right.
And the reason they told me that was because I had a 1% chance of catching cancer from
the lungs,
the recipient,
right,
or the donor, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing. Changed your life.
It really did. It made huge differences.
That's Billy O'Toole and baby Nisha talking to Ray Darcy about life with cystic fibrosis this afternoon. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Claire Byrne spoke to Professor Stephen O'Rahilly, Director of the Medical Research Council Metabolic Diseases Unit at the University of Cambridge this morning, about whether or not middle-aged spread is genetic.
So let's talk firstly about the part of the brain that controls our appetite. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, there's a couple of parts, but mainly there's a little walnut-shaped bit about an inch behind the top of your nose called the hypothalamus. And we've known for over 100 years, either in animals or humans, if you damage it accidentally or get a tumour in that area, the person or the animal becomes very obese. And they become obese because they can't control appetite, but they also burn off calories a bit more slowly. So we've known, for as I say, for a century, that that bit of the brain is important. Now, as scientists, we love to know what makes bits of everything work. You know, what are the wires and the chemicals that are involved in that bit of the brain that control those processes? And the hypothalamus, what it does really is it senses everything we eat, all the signals that come from the hormones that come up when we eat. It also senses how much fat we have from signals that come from our fat cells. And it integrates all those into a kind of signal which says you need this much food and you need to burn off this much energy. And if that bit of the brain doesn't work adequately, you're either prone to becoming obese or you're prone to being lean. And genetic variation between people is a strong determinant of what you, you know, what where you are on that spectrum. Of obesity and leanness.
Okay, so that part of our brain, hypothalamus, is affected by our genes, is it?
Very much so. I mean, everything we are is made of the gene products. You know, we can't get away from our genes. They make all the proteins in our body. So every bit of us, including our hypothalamus, is influenced by the gene variation between us.
So someone who might eat the same as somebody else might experience obesity and the other person could be lean.
That's true, but actually that's the least likely thing. What's most different is that people differ in how much they eat. But that's not because they're good or bad people. It's because their hypothalamus is set differently. And so a lot of the biology we've discovered over the last 30 years about this is that these genes and molecules tell our thinking brains when we're hungry and not hungry, when we feel like going after food or not. And so it's not a question of separating out saying there's volition on the one hand and biology on the other. It's the biology that's really powering our volition.
Mm-hmm. So it essentially is how much we are eating. That's what it comes down to. But
a lot of it. I mean, there's obviously a variation too in how efficient we are at burning off or storing calories. But the majority of the variation that we see is around how much we eat on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. Now, those variations can be very small. Remember, you don't have to have a huge amount more. Just a little bit more every day is enough over years to accumulate a lot of weight.
But our appetites are controlled in very different ways, or our appetites are set at very different levels depending on our genetics, is what you're
Absolutely.
Saying.
Absolutely, yeah. And we first discovered that 30 years ago when we found children who were very obese who had major disruptions of the wiring of the hypothalamus. I mean, really profound. And those children became obese from a very young age and remain severely obese all their lives. And, you know, what's good about that is that in many cases we've been able to find drugs and ways to bypass those wiring and chemical defects. And we have treatments for those children now, many of whom previously would have been very sick and are now healthy because we've been able to bypass the wiring defects. So the whole purpose of this work is to, you know, first of all, the curiosity about finding out how these bits of our brain are wired, but secondly, the humanitarian element of actually being able to do something about it for people who are suffering from a severe and often very poorly understood and certainly
often a disorder that doesn't bring much sympathy.
So tell us a little bit about this new research then, when it comes to people in middle age.
Yeah, so most of the things that we've found over the last 20 years, we and others around the world, but the genes that we find that really have a big effect on weight tend to affect you from a very young age. And so they tend to be, if you like, the wiring diagram is messed up from the beginning. So it's straight away, as soon as you're a child, you're already eating more than your peers and you're putting on more weight than your peers. And we thought that most of the genes would work like that, the genetic variation. So it was really surprising in this study, which was led by my brilliant colleague, John Perry, who's a statistical geneticist. So he looks at huge data sets. So this was done in the UK Biobank, 500,000 people in the UK. And simply looking at basically all the genes and looking at every gene in the genome in 500,000 people, which ones, when they were broken, were associated with the biggest effect on weight in later life. And we found mutations in a gene, which is a rather silly name, bassoon. And surprisingly, the people who carried only one damaged copy of this gene, bassoon, were hugely more obese than those who didn't carry any. And the thing that really struck us with this and another gene that we found, what really struck us was when those people reported what size they were when they were age 10, they were normal size. They weren't obese from an early age. And so that gave us a whole new class of these genes. In some ways, you can think of this, if you think of this as a wiring system, an electrical system for your house, what's going wrong here is not how the wiring is set up at the beginning, it's how the wiring is maintained. So we have a maintenance problem. When we lack this protein. And that's telling us that these systems that we have in our brain, they don't just require to be set up from the beginning. They need maintenance throughout their lives. And we've got some ideas about how the proteins that we've been finding have got an influence on the maintenance of neurons.
So this might provide answers for people who have been blaming themselves in middle age, maybe saying, oh, I'm a little more sedentary or I'm experiencing menopause. But actually their problem lies somewhere else entirely.
It could be, but of course, individually, these gene changes are rare. We only found these in 1 in 6,000 people. So there'll only be about 10,000 people in the UK, far fewer in Ireland, in whom this specific gene mutation is found. So I think it's more telling us it's important to think that these mechanisms can occur. Now, it may well be, like we've done with the other rare childhood forms, that we will be able to find a way of bypassing this defect and maybe screening once we get to a stage where we're screening whole populations, we'll be able to do something to stop these people and help them not get obese in the longer term. And that's obviously a long-term aspiration. But this individual genetic defect is rare.
Professor Stephen O'Rahilly, Director of the Medical Research Council Metabolic Diseases Unit at the University of Cambridge, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about genetic links to obesity. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio app. Until the next time, thank you for listening, and good luck.